the headlines. Iran's president says the number of coronavirus-related deaths in the country has recently decreased by 70%. Iraq's national security advisor denounces Washington's blacklisting of a senior leader of the country's popular mobilization forces. Also in the headlines, a new poll shows nearly 60% of Americans favor immediate removal of President Trump from office as Democrats push for his impeachment over the violence at Capitol Hill. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says the country's daily coronavirus death rate has dropped by 70%. Rouhani said that people's cooperation in observing the health protocols helped bring down the death tally. He added, hospital admissions of COVID-19 patients have also declined by 80%. Iran set an all-time high of 486 daily fatalities in mid-November, with day-to-day infections hovering above 13,000. The figures have seen a downward trend in recent days amid restrictions in place. The overall death toll now stands at over 56,000, while the infections are nearly 1.3 million. Rouhani also said 16 million Iranians will receive coronavirus vaccines soon in four phases. He said frontline medics, the elderly, people with disabilities, and underlying health conditions are the first to be vaccinated. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says that anti-Iran sanctions must be immediately removed. Ayatollah Sayyidali Khamenei says the sanctions are vicious and a crime against the Iranian nation.
On Friday, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, came down hard on the United States and its allies over their years-long sanctions against the Iranian people. Ayatollah Khamenei has stressed that the measures are based on a baseless animosity and have to be lifted right away. Iran's leader noted that setting conditions for the removal of sanctions is nonsense. He said a possible U.S. return to the 2015 nuclear deal would be meaningless if the sanctions stay in place. Ayatollah Khamenei threw his weight behind a recent move by the Iranian government to scale down its commitments under the deal known as the JCPOA, saying that Tehran will not accept any obligations without reciprocal measures, adding that it would be meaningless for the Islamic Republic to implement all its commitments under the JCPOA when the other side implements almost none of its. Ayatollah Khamenei slammed comments made by some Western countries over Iran's regional policies. He stressed that Tehran will continue to play its role for regional stability, like its recent contribution to Iraq and Syria that led to the defeat of the Daesh terrorist group there. The Iran leader said that it is the U.S. that finds its interest in destabilizing the region, noting that such plots have been explicitly stated by some American thinkers, including someone from the American Enterprise Institute. Speaking on Iran's defense capabilities, Ayatollah Khamenei noted that the country is strong enough now to deter a war similar to the one launched by former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein with arms and backing of the West in the 1980s. Iran's leader then touched upon recent developments surrounding the U.S. presidential election, saying the so-called American values and democracy have turned into a laughingstock even among American friends. He said what happened in Washington, D.C. was the very thing Americans were planning to incite in Iran over a decade ago.
An Iraqi national security advisor has denounced Washington's blacklisting of Fali al-Fayyad, a senior leader of the country's popular mobilization forces. Qasem al-Araji said the U.S. putting sanctions on the top Iraqi official was a wrong move. In a tweet, Araji called on the U.S. Treasury Department to rescind its decision to put Fayyad on its sanctions list. Meanwhile, the popular mobilization forces also reacted to Washington's move. It congratulated Fayyad for, quote, having joined those who the U.S. regards as its enemies. Lebanese Hezbollah movement also condemned Washington, saying that the sanctions are due to Fayyad's anti-U.S. stance. Fayyad has repeatedly called for the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq in accordance with legislation passed by Parliament. The Popular Mobilization Units is an official legal organization which operates under the command of the Iraqi Armed Forces. Yemeni political components have held an event in Sana'a to celebrate the International Day of Resistance, pledging that the Palestinian cause will remain the central issue of the Islamic nation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali has more from Sana'a.
The continued acceleration of some Arab regimes to normalize with Israel and betray the Palestinian cause. Political components in Yemen held an event to celebrate the International Day of Resistance. Representatives of Palestinian resistance movements and some state officials also participated in the event.
We in Palestine are betting a lot on the Yemeni position and the Yemeni youth. And we did not find the people in the world reviving this day, but Yemenis. This is a great day that brings us back to correct the path. The resistance is no longer the same as before. It has become strong and able to make a difference and shake the ground beneath America and Israel.
The attendees pledged to unify the ranks of the resistance axis in the face of the forces of oppression and occupation. They vowed to regain all usurped lands in all parts of Arab world, especially occupied Palestine, and to stop the American and Israeli incursion into the region.
The Palestinian cause is the central issue of the nation because it is the issue of an oppressed people who have suffered persecution, displacement, and occupation by Zionist gangs supported by America and Britain since 1948. So the compass of the resistance axis is indicating towards Palestine, and we see the resistance forces united and interconnected to liberate Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The celebration of the International Day of Resistance in Yemen coincides with the first anniversary of the assassination of top Iranian commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who had a pivotal and prominent role in supporting the Palestinian resistance movements.
The Palestinian cause is a global issue that requires humanitarian commitment, pushing all the free people of the world to stand by the axis of resistance and Palestinians until the liberation of their occupied lands. Abdulatif al-Washali, Sana'a.
U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has called on President Donald Trump to resign or face impeachment. Pelosi said that she has instructed the House Rules Committee to move forward with a motion for impeachment if Trump does not leave office voluntarily. Pelosi said in a statement after a three-hour meeting with House Democrats that the lawmakers will preserve every option, including Amendment 25, which deals with presidential succession and disability. The Democratic representatives have reportedly prepared a draft article of impeachment against Trump. U.S. media say the draft accuses Trump of engaging in high crimes and misdemeanors by inciting insurrection. Meanwhile, the U.S. president-elect has called Trump one of the most incompetent presidents in the history of the U.S.
I've been saying for now well over a year, he is not fit to serve. He is not fit to serve. He's one of the most incompetent presidents in the history of the United States of America.
Joe Biden said people who stormed the Capitol should be prosecuted. Biden also welcomed Trump's announcement that he will not attend the January 20 presidential inauguration. He stressed that he has confidence in the country's Secret Service to make sure that his inauguration goes off safely. On Wednesday, Trump's supporters stormed the Congress building in a bid to overturn his election defeat. A new opinion poll says more than half Americans want President Donald Trump to be immediately removed from office over the deadly unrest on Capitol Hill. According to the Reuters Ipsos poll, 7 out of 10 of those who voted for Trump in November opposed the storming of the Capitol grounds. Nearly 70% of Americans surveyed also said they disapprove of Trump's actions in the run-up to the assault. 5 people were killed when Trump's supporters overran the U.S. Congress on Wednesday. The Attorney General's office in the U.S. state of Colorado has opened a grand jury investigation into the 2019 death of African-American Elijah McClain in police custody. In a statement, State Attorney General Phil Weiser said that he wants to conduct an independent probe based on facts and law into the incident. 23-year-old McClain was confronted by police while walking home based on a report that he was suspicious. He died days later after being placed in a chokehold. 3 officers involved in the encounter did not face any charges. McClain's death renewed attention after the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis last summer. Killing sparked nationwide protests demanding an end to police brutality against the blacks and justice for the victim. Time now for the news review of this bulletin. Hello, welcome to the news review. North Korea's leader says Washington's hostile policies toward Pyongyang would never change, regardless of who occupies the White House. Kim Jong-un called the U.S. the biggest enemy of North Korea and an obstacle to its development. Kim said that North Korea's political activities should be focused on redirected at subduing the U.S. policies. He also called for more research and development of advanced military equipment, as well as the expansion of the country's nuclear capabilities. Kim, however, stressed that his country would not misuse its nuclear power. North Korea says its nuclear program is a strong deterrent against U.S. military threats. Talks aimed at denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula have been stalled for months over Washington's refusal to meet Pyongyang's demand for sanctions relief. Jennifer Chang is our correspondent joining us from Seoul, and we also have Aina Tangen, an author and columnist who joins us from Beijing. Jennifer Chang, what is the latest that you can give us about about North Korea's leader's statements there regarding its view on the U.S.?
Well, the North Korean leader has reported to the 8th Congress of the Ruling Workers' Party that North Korea needs to improve its strike capability for targets within the 15,000-kilometer range, and experts say that refers to the mainland U.S. So the North wants to demonstrate that it is able to hit the mainland U.S. with a nuclear-tipped ICBM and dispel any doubt from anyone that it is capable of doing that. And it says that it needs to also work on miniaturizing nuclear weapons more. There are a few skeptics who doubt that the North might be able to produce an ICBM tipped with a nuclear warhead that can re-enter the atmosphere without breaking up as it tries to hit the U.S. mainland. So the North wants to dispel any doubts from people like that. It also said it will develop tactical nuclear weapons, not just strategic nuclear weapons like the ones I've been describing. And it said that it had completed the research design of a new nuclear-powered submarine that was in the final stage of examination. So this means that the North will not only be able to hit the U.S. mainland with a nuclear-tipped ICBM fired from the North, but also from a submarine that sneaks up close to the U.S. coastline, which is far more harder for the U.S. missile defenses to detect. So this will be a big challenge for the Biden administration that's coming in now, starting on January 20th. They will not be having the upper hand at the negotiating table with the North. The North clearly has already made itself have the upper hand at the bargaining table.
What approach, Aina Tangen, will the President-elect Joe Biden have when it comes to North Korea, do you think?
Well, politically, there's no precedent can allow a country like North Korea to have a nuclear arsenal and threaten the U.S. So it's very difficult to see that this is anything but a negotiation point. The use of tactical nukes, which are we call battlefield nukes, would be represent a new level of threat, as my colleague has pointed out. So would the an ICBM and also a nuclear-powered submarine. Those are, would be too big to ignore, assuming that Biden is able to reach an agreement with Iran. That would mean that North Korea would be the sole focus of anti-nuclear activity. And it's, as I said, I don't think he would go easily into war, but it's possible that there would be some sort of action. A lot would depend on how China views this and the rest of the Asian neighbors.
So let me just pick up on two of the points there that you made. Are you saying that there is a possibility for action, as you stated, from the U.S. against North Korea? And, of course, then the China factor of how it would use North Korea, perhaps, with any type of approach that the U.S. has towards China?
Well, no, I don't think that China is going to be waving North Korea around. China does not want a nuclear neighbor, mainly because it will start a nuclear arms race throughout Asia and Southeast Asia. That would not be to China's taste. Obviously, they'd like to stop that. But things have become so polarized. The U.S., despite everything that we've seen with Donald Trump, the fact is 73 million people voted for him. These people, plus a bipartisan Congress, which is very, very anti-China, would perhaps associate this with, North Korea, and they would try to raise the rhetoric level and say that this somehow is the two of them acting. And this is what I'm concerned about, is this kind of misunderstanding and sleepwalking into a catastrophe that needs to be avoided at all costs.
Jennifer Chang, in terms of talks with the U.S. from the North Korean leader, any strong statements that point to that direction?
Well, the Biden administration that will be coming in just a couple of days has made it clear that it is willing to sit down at the negotiating table with the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un. However, like the previous Trump administration, it is insisting on denuclearization before it lifts sanctions and before it provides security guarantees like declaring formally an end to the Korean War, which is still going on because technically it cannot be ended until a permanent peace treaty is signed, and that was not signed at the end of the 1950 to 1953 Korean War. Instead, an armistice was signed. So the North now has the upper hand, and the Biden administration will be under a lot of pressure to try to produce an agreement, and that may well lead to it making more concessions than the previous Biden administration. The North has said the U.S. never changes its hostile policy, no matter who the president is, and until the U.S. does that, it is not going to denuclearize or stop developing and advancing its nuclear weapons capability.
Jennifer Chang, thank you very much. Correspondent there from Seoul. Ina Tang, and a pleasure. Author and columnist there from Beijing. Many thanks. And that does it for our news review. Thanks for tuning in. China has tightened restrictions following a new outbreak of COVID-19 infections in its northern province. Spike in Hebei, bordering the capital of Beijing, sparked fresh lockdowns ahead of the Lunar New Year next month. Hebei reported over 130 new cases in the past week, with more than 200 asymptomatic infections. Authorities have warned that the upcoming New Year festivities will further boost the restriction of transmission. Meanwhile, Australia is on high alert after cases of highly transmissible new COVID variants that were detected in the country. It has imposed three-day strict lockdowns on the third-largest city, Brisbane. The discovery of the new strain has cut the number of travelers from overseas and requires negative COVID-19 tests from those boarding planes. Australia has recorded around 20,000 infections and 909 deaths since the start of the pandemic. And that is it for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Aperture.
Being the second largest country in the Middle East, Iran is rich with a colorful bouquet of architectural masterpieces, magnificent mosques, ancient caravanserais, impressive rock tombs, and former royal cities of the ancient Persian Empire. But perhaps Iran's amazing desert landscape has been largely overlooked. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Iran's deserts are unique in the variety of their composition and surface types. A yardang, or kalut, as they're called in Farsi, is a topographical feature that has been carved out of a surface by the wind. They're most commonly found in deserts where there is a sand supply, which abrades the surface when moved by the wind, and soft sedimentary rocks that the sand easily erodes. Over time, the sand wears down the surface into beautiful streamlined shapes that are aligned with the prevailing sand-moving winds. Iran is famous for mega yardangs in Kerman in the south of the country. Stay with us for this episode of Iran Trotter as we follow Javad to discover the spectacular Kalutz in Iran.
To most humans, nature means trees, jungles, rivers, and mountains. But is that all there is to this beautiful nature created by the architect of all beauties? God is limitless. He is infinite and has created nature with infinite beauties. Nature has many and varied complicated aspects, and the natural world in Iran is no exception. Many people do not consider deserts and wastelands as part of nature. But the fact is, deserts constitute a large part of the environment on our planet. All we have to do is open our eyes and look at these countless, peerless beauties. Hi. I'm Javad Gharai. I'm an Iran trotter, and I'm traveling to the most pristine areas of my beloved country and uncovering to you its many beauties. This time, I've come to a vast city in Kerman province, a city that in fact forms a major swath of the amazing landscape in Kerman. The fictitious city of Kalutz. I set out on a 110-kilometer walking journey to the northeast of Kerman province to arrive at my main destination. The Yardangs are located in an area spanning 11,000 square kilometers in the west of Iran's Lut Desert. The Yardangs of Lut cover an area around 150 kilometers long and around 70 kilometers wide. In the words of some researchers, this vast expanse used to be the bed of a lake sometime in the third geological period, and that in fact the Yardangs, or the Kalutz, are made up of brittle sediments lying at the bottom of that lake. At some point in the third geological period, the lake dried up as a result of the major climatic changes that occurred on Earth. Torrential rains and their ensuing humidity in the following periods and water erosion led to the creation of the Kalutz or Yardangs. Other researchers believe the Yardangs are the result of the alluvial deposits originating from Birjan Mountains in the distant past. Sharp temperature fluctuations in the Lut and the constant blowing of local winds carrying abrasive sediment loads of sandstones battering these Yardangs over the years have led to their erosion. Winds that continue to lash out at these Yardangs and eventually raise beautiful clay terraces to the ground. Hello.
trips to the heart of deserts and wastelands have always been risky. But studying up on such places and the risks involved in traveling to them, not to mention carrying a proper map, a GPS device, and the topographic map of the area you are traveling to, can bring the number of risks involved down to a great extent. In all fairness, one of the most beautiful areas in the Lut Desert is the Shahdad Yardangs of Kerman. I mean, there are few places in the world with such beautiful desert landscape. I think nowhere in the world can you find a landscape as vast as this one. Here I am in the Lut Yardangs, hoping for a good trip, and I'm positive it's gonna be a thrill. I stepped onto a part of the river that not many people were interested in traveling to for several reasons. The flight distance between the Yardangs and the Yalan Mega Dunes in the west of Lut is around 150 kilometers. For several consecutive years, part of the Yalan Mega Dunes was announced by NASA as one of the hottest spots on Earth. This is an area where temperatures run above 70 degrees in the summer. With no trace of life among them, the Yardangs of Lut look scary to human eyes. Although in recent years, some researchers have discovered and registered a number of plants and insect species in them. But at first look, the fictional town of Kaluts or Yardangs bears no trace of life of any kind. Encountering sandstorms in the desert or getting lost in them, or all the other hidden dangers of such terrains, can put your life at grave risk. But none of those reasons stop me from walking right into the Yardangs. You can enjoy spending time in this beautiful natural landscape with enough information on its climate and terrain, and by using a map and GPS device. No one has found any trace of human habitation in the Kaluts area, not in the past and not in the present eras. But on the outskirts of these beautiful Kaluts, there are many remnants of human habitation from years gone by. The Kaluts are located on the outskirts of Shahdad, a city in Kerman that is among the most ancient in Iran. A place with a more than 6,000-year-old culture and history. The world's oldest metal flag was discovered here. The many kanats and water reservoirs on the outskirts of the Kaluts, as well as the lush gardens of Shahdad, are evidence of human settlement in the distant past. Right at the beginning of the route, I came across an area with a concentration of strange Kalud formations, a place famous for its egg-shaped hills. I have to walk a long distance to get to the heart of the Shahdad Kaluts. But the beautiful elevations you see behind me, which is sort of the prelude to the main Kaluts, are called the egg-shaped hills, and for good reason. They really do look like eggs, although these hills are considered as little Kaluts. The reason they have been abraded more than the other Kaluts in this region is rainfalls and, of course, the type of soil they are made from. And if it goes on like this, rainwater and wind are going to destroy them in the not-too-distant future. Every spot you go to in this region, you see new and different Kaluts or Yardangs.
The majority of those who travel to the Kaluts are not aware of the diversity of the landscapes in this terrain and its natural phenomena. But the fact is, the Kaluts of Kerman are a peerless kaleidoscope of beautiful desert landscapes. Everywhere you look in this region, you see spectacular yet peculiar sights. Around 7 kilometers after the X-shaped hills, I arrived at another strange yet interesting scenery. From a distance, I thought I was approaching some prehistoric cemetery. But well, this is not a cemetery. The mounds are called the Dolphin Hills. In fact, they are very small kaluts in the vicinity of the big ones. The dual action of wind abrasion and rainwater has chiseled them to look like dolphins swimming on a wave of dust and sand. Every part of the kaluts in Shahdad has its own unique shape. And these Dolphin Hills are among those unique parts of the Shahdad Kaluts. These are really extraordinary, really beautiful. I've been walking around in the Shahdad Kaluts for hours now, deep into the heart of these remarkable protuberances. Although it is fall now, and the best season to travel to the Lut Desert, and of course to the Shahdad Kaluts, early spring is also a good time. Anyway, it's noontime and very hot. It was very cold in the morning, but now the temperature keeps going up, so I'm gonna have to take a layer off. The temperature in the desert fluctuates sharply between the morning and the evening. It's always like that. So you have to remember to pack the right clothes for summer and winter weather. That's what it's like in the desert. You get summer and winter weather at the same time, happening within hours of each other on a single day. You should keep that in mind. It's really getting hot here. I just hope it'll stop right there as we approach noontime. Because, I mean, the sun, the heat from the sun can just be unbearable. Although I've already thought of something for a situation like this, one of the most important things we have to carry with us when traveling through deserts and wastelands are glasses, sunglasses that is. They're very important to protecting your eyes against the scorching sun. When the rays of the sun reach the dirt, they are reflected in your direction and bother your eyes. The air here is very clean. That's why there's so much light. So you have to wear sunglasses if you ever come to a place like this. If you don't, your vision is going to get hurt, and you're going to get wrinkles around your eyes. And that's what the ladies are very sensitive about. Dazzling beauties of the Kaluts redoubled my enthusiasm for traveling into the heart of these sand formations. But the deeper I walked into them, the more arduous things became. Walking on the sand in the punishing heat requires strenuous effort and drains your energy. The day started out cold, but the temperatures kept going up as I approached midday. The biting autumn cold was nowhere to be felt. Walking on the sand and grit really wears you out after a while. And it makes you sweat a lot, too. It's starting to get really hot. I'd better change into something more suitable. I'm wearing a thin layer, but the short sleeves expose my forearms to the sun, and that means sunburn. The sun is just bearing down on me. I feel like it's burning my face. I mean, I really had to change my clothes to avoid getting sunburn on my arms. The sun can get really annoying round about noontime out in the desert, even if it's not very hot. You're bound to get sunburned. So you must wear long-sleeve shirts with good breathability at the same time. I mean, that's what I always do. And I've never run into any problems because long sleeves have always protected my arms against the sun. Now, more important than wearing long-sleeve shirts out in the desert is to have proper headgear, such as this hat. What this hat does is it prevents the radiation from the sun from reaching your head to a great extent. And as a result, your face, neck, and ears won't get burnt. It really feels good when you wear one of these. And of course, a good pair of sunglasses is a must-have in a place like this. But there is another type of sunglasses, that I carry with me all the time. These are called storm goggles by some and skiing goggles by others. It's important to pack a pair of these goggles too, because when there is a sandstorm, when strong winds start blowing, they kick up a lot of sand and other particles into the air, and the goggles prevent them from going into your eyes. More important than that, you can see where you're going when you're out in the sticks without worrying about sand getting into your eyes. Man, I'm beat. It really wears you out when you walk on sand and up and down on those little hills. It's just fatiguing. I dare say, walking about in the Kalutz area and the hot areas of Lut Desert in the summer is next to impossible. The temperatures are so high and the surface of the earth so hot, you won't last more than a few kilometers. That's a time when you cannot see any living creatures in the Lut Desert. You can only see them during the night. It's very important to carry enough water when you travel to a place like this. If you're going to spend 2, 3, or 4 days trekking in the desert, make sure you have enough water. That's because you sweat a lot and your body loses a lot of water. And obviously, when that happens, you become dehydrated. In addition to that, you have to eat food that contains salt. But if your food doesn't contain enough salt, you need to eat salty nuts. That's because your body loses a lot of sodium as you sweat in the heat, and that's going to harm your body. Okay, now let's eat an orange. The Kalutz expand intermittently from the west of the Lut Desert towards the southeast. The corridors formed among them look in the same direction as the Kalutz themselves, that is, in the direction of the local winds. They are all very brittle. The shape of each Kalut depends on how it was first formed, its density, and the direction of the winds that brush against it on their paths. Shifting winds and other erosive factors in the Kalut's basin has created a variety of them with different shapes and sizes. In some places, winds have filled the depression around the Kalut's with sand, and in other places, they have blown away the sand from around them. Now, let's take a look at the etymology of the word Kalut. Kalut is a blend of two words, Kal and Lut. Together, they mean the city of Lut. In the Khorasan region, in central Iran, and along the coast of the Caspian Sea, the word Kal has taken on different meanings. In Khorasan and Sistan and Baluchistan, it's the root of words such as kalate and kalat, meaning castle or citadel. It could also mean a hamlet or a village perched on an elevation. In the center of Iran, the word kalat means a walled-off village. The Kaluts are an imaginary city. From a distance, they look like the remains of a ruined city. Of course, there are a few other areas like this in some parts of the world, but the Kalutz of Iran cover the largest such area in the world. Without human interference and technology, Mother Nature has put on display her unique artistic talent and creativity. It was starting to get dark when, on a nature trip, it's important that the nature traveler find the right spot where they can pitch their tent before the dark sets in. That will ensure a good night's rest without any trouble. I'm going to call it a day now, and I think the best place for me to camp out is right here next to a lone kalut surrounded by sand. The wind has created this hole here as if to prepare it for someone to set up their tent in. This is perfect because here I'll have my back to the wind, which usually blows from the heights of Siuj Mountains back there towards the kaluts. I mean, that's why this hole has been created. This kalut hasn't allowed sand to accumulate here, hence the evenly shaped depression around it. It's just the perfect place to camp out. We're spending the night here. It's a great spot, and hopefully we're going to have a star-studded sky above us. Okay, I've been told I wouldn't be able to find any firewood or shrubs or any living creatures because deep in the heart of the kaluts, the winds are so strong they won't allow any vegetation to grow on their path. In other words, if a plant grows here, it gets blown away by the wind. But there is an exception to that rule, and that is an area located on the path of floodwaters flowing down to the kaluts area from the Ravar Mountains. The floods uproot the shrubs on the banks of the rivers nearby, the ones near the kaluts, that is, and dump them in the seasonal river that's created near here and eventually brings them over to the kaluts area. I might be able to find something there to make a fire here tonight to keep me and others warm. The temperatures in the Lut Desert fluctuate constantly, making life a bit difficult for nature travelers. Therefore, I always pack warm clothes and a good warm sleeping bag. Another beauty of the desert is its star-studded night sky. In the absence of light pollution, you get a clear view of the twinkling stars and part of the Milky Way. You can spend hours feasting your eyes on those beautiful celestial bodies that adorn the expansive firmament above. I'm glad I found these sticks. It gets really cold out here at night. I rarely make fire during my trips because I set a lot of store by nature and even dry sticks of wood. These sticks are a form of energy. They are no different than oil and gas, so we shouldn't use them recklessly. As I say, I don't make fire when I camp out unless I really have to. Most of the time, I don't need to, and when I do, I make a small one. But in the Lut Desert and in the Shahdad Desert, temperatures fluctuate a lot. I remember coming here 3 years ago. One night, winter was about to come to an end. I mean, like 2 or 3 days to the end of the season, 3 years ago. That night, right here in the Lut Desert, the temperature plunged to -1 degrees. Here's the thing. In the day, at midday, I mean, I had traveled deeper into this area and experienced temperatures as high as 43 degrees. That's a huge difference in one single day. It was all very strange to me. But well, that's what deserts are like. It's typical of them. It can get really cold during the night, especially during fall and winter. Therefore, you have to have proper clothes to wear. And if you manage to find a few sticks, you can keep yourself warm and enjoy yourself sitting around a campfire.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the Impalibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters all across the globe, wherever you are, and whenever it is that you are listening to this show. One of the salient and prominent qualities of a good Muslim is, in fact, tolerance. Never has it been seen through history, never has it been reported in any book, in any source, that Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam or the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam were intolerant, were easily aggravated, were hostile or abusive toward people outside of their school of thought, their religion. Never. So if we're going to take them as our role models, and if we're going to hold them as the lanterns that guide us through the darker moments of life, we have to step into their footsteps, and we have to follow their example, especially when it comes to treating people that we don't necessarily agree with. One of the examples that people often talk about regarding this matter is that of Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Revolution, especially during his time outside of Iran and France at Nivelle Le Chapon. He was a great example of coexistence. He was a great example of being at peace with people who don't agree with your religion. And he was a very good example of how you don't necessarily have to go and invite everyone to Islam. He was a Marja, and probably he had the most knowledge regarding Islam and Islamic fiqh and Islamic rulings and history and narrations and this and that than anyone else in all of France. But he didn't find the need to go door to door and say, can we introduce you to our Lord and Savior? Would you like to embrace Islam? Here's a pamphlet about my religion. Why don't you read that? And let me tell you about what's going to happen to you if you don't believe in Islam and how you're going to burn in hell and all for all of eternity. Sometimes that's needed. Sometimes that's the manifestation, that's the example of coexisting. And we need to understand that. And we're going to be right back after this short little story regarding Imam Khomeini.
The title of today's story is Imam Ruhullah Mousavi Khomeini. French physician Dr. Louis, who was in his teens in the closing month of 1978, when the Imam Khomeini made the Paris suburb of Neuf-le-Château, says, "That day when my father returned home from work, he angrily took off his coat and said, 'This year I have been stalked by misfortune. On one hand, the company is facing bankruptcy, and on the other, our suburb has lost its peace.' My mother consoled him, saying, 'Don't worry, this said that Ayatollah Khomeini will leave within some days to Iran.' Louis adds, 'I was curious to see this great religious leader of Iran who was in our neighborhood. I joined reporters who were daily converging on the area and went to the edge of the orchard where Imam Khomeini was staying. I saw an old but enlightened man in robes sitting cross-legged under a shady tree and talking in cool and calm voice.'" Dr. Louis continues, "I told my father that if he wanted to see a personality who inspired the same feelings as Jesus, peace be upon him, then he should come and hear Ayatollah Khomeini. I finally managed to convince my father, and the next day we went together to see this great spiritual leader from Iran. Ayatollah Khomeini's punctuality very much impressed me. He came on time and sat at the usual place where he used to meet the press. Minutes later, I looked at my father's face. He was listening carefully, and it was apparent that he was very much impressed by Ayatollah Khomeini. A few days later, it was Christmas. we sat for the celebrations when the doorbell suddenly rang. A man with a bouquet of flowers and package of confectionery was standing at the door. He greeted us cheerfully and handed to my father the bouquet and the confectionery, saying, "This is a present from Ayatollah Khomeini." He congratulated us on the birthday of Jesus and asked forgiveness if he had disturbed our Christmas celebration. Oh, my father thanked the man and stood amazed at all this love and affection from a Muslim divine.
The lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
I'm not entirely sure who Dr. Louis is, and to be honest, I looked up his name and I couldn't find anything. But if we take this story as some sort of anecdote with lessons within it to be learned, it would still make sense. And parts of it are actually true and they really occurred and they're historically authentic. Such as the fact that Imam Khomeini, Ayatollah Khomeini, Rahmatullah Alayh, gave out sweets and, you know, small gifts to his Christian neighbors during Christmas as an act of tolerance, you know, as if you want to claim that your religion is all about peace, it's all about coexistence, if you want to claim that my religion isn't different from the religion that Jesus Christ, peace be upon him, brought forth and the prophets before him, you kind of got to prove it, you know. And reaching out to your neighbors during a time that is sacred, that is important to them, and making them feel good through a kind and sweet gesture is one of the greatest ways to express your religion. Just like Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam has said in a narration, that be a means and a source of beauty for us. Don't embarrass us. Or the other hadith that, again, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam says, that preach people or invite people toward religion through means other than your tongue. By that act of kindness and peacemaking, Imam Khomeini basically engraved something into the minds and the hearts of his Christian neighbors during that period he lived in France. And it was that I might be a clergy, I might be a political figure, I might be spiritual leader for many, I might be the center of the world's attention, and I might have been so for the past few years and for the next few years as well, but that doesn't mean that I can't abide by ethical, moral, humane rules regarding ethics and kindness toward other human beings. This act basically showed us that we're never above kindness, no matter how important we are, no matter how busy we are, and no matter what our achievements are in life. Because at the end of the day, even if we're king of the world, and we've earned that position through tears, blood, and sweat, it doesn't mean a darn thing if we cannot express kindness and empathy and benevolence toward our fellow human beings. At the end of the day, what makes us a valuable human is how we make other people feel. Sure, contributing to the level of their intelligence and their knowledge and helping them become smarter and gaining more information is really important. But again, if that information and knowledge that we impart to them doesn't help with making them kinder toward themselves and other human beings and other life forms, then what use is it really? That's all the time we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Thank you so very much for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.